welcome to the Kotsk Podcast. I'm Jordan Wozniak.
And I am Gavin Michael.
This is episode 9, the origins of a latecomer davening in full at the expense of reciting the Amida with the community. Good morning, Gavin. How are you?
Good afternoon, Jordan. I'm very well, and you?
I'm very well, thank you. Now that we're 7 hours apart, we have to be creative with our scheduling.
Right.
But we're making it work. And not only are we 7 hours apart, we're 6 months apart in weather because it's snowy and cold outside here. And you're in the heat of early summer down in South Africa.
Yes, and if it's any consolation, I made sure that I just had some breakfast before I spoke to you at 3:30 in the afternoon. Yes.
Excellent. Thank you. Thank you for aligning your schedule.
All right.
Very good. So today's episode, we're talking about, I think, an issue that is both global and particular at the same time, right? Because the issue that we're going to be talking about today is, I think, in many ways, a general one about how halacha is decided and implemented and how practices develop over time and how the authority of something like the Shulchan Aruch is, you know, weighed against other traditions. And we're also talking about a particular event that happened at a particular point and place in Jewish history where there were sensitivities to what was going on that may not have applied in other times. And I have to say, when I first read this article, Gavin, that I was kind of, you know, the basis for how this whole issue developed, the story that we're going to tell you today, I was mystified at first because I thought, why, you know, we're talking about what does someone who comes late to shul, okay, and we're using Ashkenazi language here for something that happened in the Sephardi milieu. So let's say what happens when someone who comes late to the synagogue and the tefillah has already started and he or she is late, and what is he supposed to do? And I thought, well, why do other people really care so much? And there's a good reason why. So I'll stop now, and perhaps you can tell us the story, the backstory for what's going on here. What was this event? Who are these people? Why did they care?
All right. Thank you for that introduction, Jordan. I think we should start off by saying that there exists to this day a custom that actually was a custom that I've been following all my life because I come from a Hasidic background. And the custom is that if one, in the unlikely event of someone arriving late in the synagogue.
Unlikely, yes.
Very, very unlikely. Does he follow what the Shulchan Aruch says, which is basically say parts of the Psukei Dezimra, say Ashrei, say Yishtabach, a couple of important prayers, and just try and squeeze in so that he'd be able to say the Amida with the congregation, with the Tzibur. That's what the Shulchan Aruch of Rabbi Yosef Karo suggests that one does, and that is the standard halacha. But this wasn't my custom, and it's not the custom of many people who follow the practices of the Arizal and a lot of the Hasidic customs. My custom was, and funny enough, it's a custom that I have encouraged other people to do, people who come to my shul, I tell them, don't worry about trying to keep up with the chazan, just daven at your own pace, because that is how I was brought up, and that is how I always used to daven. And the rationale is a very simple rationale, and that is that the order of prayers has cosmic significance. And as soon as one starts to jumble up that order, one changes the heavenly conduits and channels and pipes, and the shefa going up and down is somehow disturbed or even blocked, and the prayers become, in a sense, defective. So it's more important, therefore, to keep to the order of the davening so that you don't mix up the heavenly channels. And I actually always believed that this was either a custom of the Baal Shem Tov or a custom of the Arizal, but as it turns out, not at all. The origins of this custom were in a very, very different, from a very different place and a very different time. And that place and time was Amsterdam in 1706. Very, very unlikely origins of this custom. So basically what happened one morning in shul, A local rabbi in Amsterdam, Rabbi David Mendes da Silva, arrives in shul late. And he starts davening, and he ignores the Amidah. He doesn't say the Amidah with the congregation, and he carries on davening. Someone in the shul, probably sitting close by him, was Nathan Curiel, observed what was going on, and he picks out David Mendes da Silva and says, "What are you doing? You know you're supposed to daven Amidah with the community. Why are you continuing and ignoring the Shulchan Aruch?" David Mendes da Silva turns around and he says, "But I obey the custom or even the law of the Zohar. The Zohar prescribes, allegedly, that one continues davening at one's own pace and one keeps the order of the davening, no chopping and changing, no mingling, no intermingling of the prayers, and one just carries on davening as one would normally daven because one doesn't want to mix up the heavenly channels."
Mm-hmm.
So you asked earlier on, Jordan, what was so strange about what's the big deal? Is
Why do people care?
Correct. Is Nathan Curiel being over inquisitive? Is he being, to use an Ashkenazic term, too much of a yenta? Is he sticking his nose somewhere where it doesn't belong? What's going on over here? So this leads to a fascinating understanding of the culture at that time. There were two things that were taking place, particularly as it happens in Amsterdam in 1706. Number one, probably this was the most pressing origin of this problem in the shul, and that was that it was just about 40 years after the death of Shabsai Tzvi, the false Messiah, yes. And there were a lot of secret Sabbateans, as we know, that infiltrated the mainstream, and they were everywhere in the Jewish community, in the Sephardic community, in the Ashkenazi community, in Europe, in Africa, in the Middle East, in North Africa, they were everywhere.
And as we discussed on one of our previous episodes, Amsterdam was one of the major centers of conflict between the Sabbateans and the, call them anti-Sabbateans.
Absolutely. In fact, the Sabbateans were called Ma'aminim. They were the people who believed, right. And those who opposed the Sabbateans were the exception. They were called the Kofrim, the deniers. So, Sabbateanism was very, very entrenched within the Jewish community in general in the world at the time, and particularly in Amsterdam. Amsterdam was a scene of a lot of conflict between the anti-Sabbateans and these Sabbateans. So someone changing the format of davening would have been viewed very, very suspiciously. And I think that this is quite key to understanding what Nathan Curiel was doing when he picked out David Mendes da Silva. He noticed that he was doing something out of the ordinary. He probably suspected that David Mendes da Silva was a secret Sabbatean or something like that, he's subverting the normative or nomian practices of prayer, halacha, and davening in shul.
And the other concern would have been that even if not a Sabbatean, that this person is perhaps a returned converso or part of a community of returned conversos who have been influenced by Catholic practice in some way, right?
Right. And these would have been Spanish Jews, they would have been Portuguese Jews. And as it happens, this was the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. So it certainly would have been frequented by those Portuguese conversos or former conversos and Spanish conversos or former conversos. And what was the problem with the conversos? Besides the general problem as to how does one treat or regard a converso, what is their status in halakha, but that's a topic for another discussion. One of the reasons why they were so pedantic in this particular synagogue in 1706 was because the shul was full of these returning conversos. And mm-hmm. remember, most of them would have come from some kind of a Catholic background, possibly even a Catholic upbringing. They were now coming back to Judaism. Some of them might have even been secret practicing Jews, Maranos, conversos. They regarded, because they had such a strict Catholic upbringing, they regarded the shul service or the synagogue service almost akin to the service in a Catholic church. Dignity right. had to be maintained, had to be preserved. The shul or the synagogue was a symbol of religion. Judaism wouldn't have been a way of life so much for these people as it was their religion. So as long as you went to synagogue on Saturday, you'd be like a Catholic going to church on Sunday. And I don't mean any disrespect to any Catholics, but I'm just saying that this was their this was the upbringing that they would have had. They had rule books for how one conducts oneself in the shul. And these went far right. beyond halakha. There were practices, norms and standards, if you like. Seating, you couldn't just sit anywhere. And this is not just on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur if you get upset that someone sits in your seat, if you've booked a seat. Seating in shul in general was something that was very, very regulated. Usually it had to do with wealth, unfortunately. Getting called up to the Torah, there was a protocol. Leaving the shul at certain times, everybody would look down their noses at you. If you sat at the wrong time or you stood at the wrong time, everybody would look at you. If you brought a weapon into the shul, you'd be excommunicated. And a lot of these very, very strict protocols and practices in the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam were not the standard practice. In general, shuls at the time who would have had a far more relaxed attitude towards davening. So this then would be the second reason why Nathan Curiel would have been suspicious of this out of the ordinary behavior of his fellow worshiper David Mendes da Silva.
It's really interesting, actually, because it seems you know that. It's not like this Portuguese community was like non-Orthodox. Mm. That's an anachronistic term to use to describe this era that we're talking about. But this kind of emphasis on particular behavior, it's kind of, I'm sure for me, probably for many people listening, kind of foreign concept. That's not how we usually think about shul, but it was a different kind of attitude towards the role of the synagogue and acceptable behavior. But in any case, So Nathan Curiel observes David Mendes da Silva basically starting his tefillah from the very beginning and going through and not attempting to synchronize his Shemona Esrei with the Kahal, and then goes to Rav Yitzchak Sasportas to ask a question about it. And we've heard about the Sasportas family already from one of our early episodes about Shabbatai Tzvi, because the Sasportases were known for being fierce anti-Sabbateans. And so what happened with this inquiry to the Sasportas family?
All right, so the case got brought to one of the important rabbis in Amsterdam at the time. That's Rabbi Yitzchak Sasportas, not to be confused with Rabbi Yaakov Sasportas, the famous anti-Sabbatian, the fierce anti-Sabbatian, the Moroccan-born Yaakov Sasportas. I saw an interesting thing, actually, just this morning I was reading. Yaakov Sasportas wrote, just as in parenthesis, having come from Morocco, he says that during his day there wasn't a single rabbi from Morocco or from Algiers who was not a Sabbatian. So I think this ties in with what we were saying earlier on about how widespread this movement actually was. But we're not talking about Yaakov Sasportas now. This is his son, Yitzchak Sasportas. So the case gets taken to Yitzchak Sasportas. Yitzchak Sasportas records everything duly in his notes, which later became published in a book called Siach Yitzchak. So it's a lovely book because in that book we have records of the court case and of the various arguments to and fro, which is fascinating because it goes far beyond what they were actually discussing in that particular case. There were ramifications that were, you know, spread and touched on various aspects of Jewish law. But essentially what happened was David Mendes da Silva gets called into Yitzchak Sasportas, and David Mendes da Silva basically says that he's basing himself on the Zohar. So Yitzchak Sasportas, I would imagine, nods his head wisely and says, okay, well, let's have a look at this Zohar. And let's see what this Zohar says. So they open up the Zohar, and the Zohar basically says, this is a Zohar at the end of Parshat Bamidbar. The Zohar says that the structure of the davening in Shul is very significant. The words and the actions play a very, very important part in the process of davening. And the Zohar says that one starts off by saying the korbanos. One reads the section of the sacrifices at the beginning of the davening. Then one accepts upon oneself the Ol Malchut Shamayim, the heavenly yoke, by reciting the Psukei Dezimra, which would be the Psalms of David. You know, the Psalms around Ashrei, all the Hallelujahs after Ashrei. Then one comes to the prayer that he said sitting, which would be the Shema, and that corresponds to the arm tefillin or the hand tefillin. And then one comes to the Amidah. So one ascends in order all the time throughout the process of the prayer, and the Amidah corresponds to the head tefillin. So essentially the Zohar says that there's an action and there's a speech that follows the action. When the action is not correct, when the action is faulty, the speech cannot rest. It has no space. It has no purchase. It has no traction. It's got no place to rest. And it kind of dissipates and or remains in limbo, and the davening is not a davening. And the person who did such a davening created a defect in the upper worlds and in the lower worlds. So that essentially is a summary of what the Zohar at the end of Parashat Bamidbar says, and this is the proof that David Mendes da Silva tries to bring for davening in order. Now, you can understand why he used this as a proof, because at first glance, it does seem to be saying that the order is important. There's a hierarchy in the prayers. One starts off low and one ends high, and there's a process in the middle. But the Zohar does not explicitly say that one must forego davening the Amidah with the community. The Zohar does emphasize that there is an order to davening which is of cosmic significance, yes. But the Zohar does not say, the Zohar does not unequivocally say that one follows that order at the expense of missing out on your tefillah b'tzibur, particularly davening the Shemona Esrei with the community.
So, I would say even the Zohar doesn't mention in this passage, probably it does elsewhere, but in this passage does not acknowledge the concept of tefillah b'tzibur at all, right? It doesn't specify whether it's talking about private prayer or public prayer.
It's not even talking about, yes, you could be davening at home for that matter, I would imagine. Yeah. I don't believe that Zohar is necessarily talking about davening specifically with the minions, just talking in general about the more of the structure of the prayer, I would imagine.
Right.
So that's what Yitzchak Sasportas says to David Mendes da Silva. He says, yes, it sounds very nice, but it's not, the Zohar does not say forego the Amidah with the community. And they started debating this role, this interplay between halakha and the Kabbalah in general. And Yitzchak Sasportas was basically saying, he was explaining to his colleague, because David Mendes da Silva was a rabbi as well, he was explaining to him that only where the Zohar is silent on something, Or rather, when the Talmud is silent on something, one would follow, one could then choose to follow the Zohar. But if the Talmud pronounces on a matter, one cannot overrule the Talmud by bringing in something from the Zohar.
Mm-hmm.
So David Mendes da Silva listens to that, and he brings in his second argument now. He didn't seem to push that first argument because the Zohar was not that clear. It appears that the Zohar was not as clear as David Mendes da Silva thought it was. So he brings a second argument or a second support for himself. Now, a lot of the Spanish rabbis believed that the Zohar always trumped the Gemara. This is not a standard Jewish practice, but I suppose from the Kabbalistic background of many of the Spanish Jews, the Zohar would have been the body of literature that superseded the literature of the Talmud. And David Mendes da Silva seems to quote these Spanish rabbis, and he says, if there's ever a machloket or an argument between Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, the alleged author of the Zohar, and the rabbis of the Talmud, we follow Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. So he disagreed with what Rabbi Yitzhak Sasportas had just explained to him, and he said, no, Rabbi Sasportas, you are wrong. We always follow the Zohar, even when it contradicts a statement from the Gemara or a statement from the Talmud. Well, David Mendes da Silva then pulls out the Yosef Karo card, so to speak.
Right.
He says, well, Rabbi Yosef Karo, known also as the Bet Yosef, actually wrote, and I quote, we do not abandon the words of the Zohar for the words of the Poskim. In other words, he's quoting from Rabbi Yosef Karo in the Beit Yosef. So essentially he's quoting from the author of the Shulchan Aruch, because the Beit Yosef later became the Shulchan Aruch, or it was the Shulchan Aruch was based on the Beit Yosef. It was all written by the same person, Rabbi Yosef Karo. So he's basically saying Rabbi Yosef Karo says, if there's an argument between the Poskim, you know, the Talmudic sages and the Zohar, we follow the Zohar. So now it seems amazing. Now it seems as if Rabbi Yosef Karo is siding himself with some of these Spanish Kabbalists who says that the Kabbalah always trumps the Gemara. And he's bringing a proof and actually brings a quote from Rabbi Yosef Karo. So now it's a slam dunk. As you would say, do you say that in Canada or you just do ice hockey? I'm not sure. But
We'd say, yeah, people know what you mean when you say slam dunk. Okay. That's fine. Right. We play basketball too.
All right. So he thought that he had won the argument because he had brought a proof basically from the author of the Shulchan Aruch. Rabbi Yitzhak Sasportas was a great scholar. He shows that David Mendes da Silva had misquoted or taken out of context, the statement of Rabbi Yosef Karo, only mentioned the second part of the sentence. The beginning part of the sentence said, regarding a certain matter, they were talking about something else. It says, since this particular law that Yosef Karo was talking about is not stated explicitly in the Talmud, we do not abandon the words of the Zohar for the words of the Poskim. In other words, when the Talmud is silent, we can choose to follow something in the Zohar, but not where there actually is a pronouncement by the Talmud. You then cannot override the ruling of the Talmud for something that's in the Zohar. So David Mendes da Silva's second argument with what he thought was his proof from Rabbi Yosef Karo was a proof only taken out of context and only a quotation from half of the full context of Rabbi Yosef Karo.
And even despite that, I mean, one of the thing that strikes me is, and this is probably naive on my part, but the whole idea that, you know, we don't, you know, that there's, the Zohar is on a kind of maybe not equal, but comparable footing to the poskim, to the Talmud in deciding matters of halacha, is actually, like, when you step back a bit, that's actually an incredible statement. And it kind of sounds foreign now because we don't go looking into the Zohar for halachic guidance. Like, this is not a common practice. I'm sure, you know, the Zohar is, there's concept in Zohar that come into halacha, and I'm sure we can talk about that later. But the idea that, you know, we will use the Zohar as a primary source to determine halachic practice and put it on a level comparable to the Gemara is an amazing thing to contemplate. It shows how influential it was.
It is, and the Zohar, just to support your argument, is the Zohar is called the Zohar HaKadosh, the Holy Zohar. The Gemara is not called Talmud, Talmud HaKadosh, or the Holy Talmud, but the Zohar is called the Holy Zohar. One of the arguments that the Kabbalists bring is that if Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was indeed the author of the Zohar, let's assume for this discussion that he was, he was a second century Tanna, which means he was an early Tanna, which gives him the authority actually of a Tanna, not an Amora. You know, it's a rabbi from the period of the Mishnah, not a rabbi from the period of the later Gemara, which places him in a very, very authoritative position. And that might have also been part of the argument that the just like a Mishnah can override a Gemara, so well, the Zohar is essentially a Mishnah. It has the status of a Mishnah.
Right.
So that could have been part of that argument.
Yeah, absolutely. That does make sense. That does make sense. Although one can imagine, you know, when you people living in this time in the 1600s, 1700s, and, you know, saying, you know, well, okay, here's this practice that is recommended or suggested by the Zohar, and it is, you know, perhaps foreign to what we do, because what we do is based on the Chachamim, Zichronom Livracha, and, you know, this is what evolved over time. But, oh, it looks like we're maybe wrong. We've been doing it wrong,
yes.
And we need to correct our practice based on what the Zohar says. But that's a separate issue, maybe. Right. We should talk now about the Sidur of the Arizal, because this is also a potential proof text for David Mendes da Silva.
Yeah, so let's go back to the study of Rabbi Yitzhak Sasportis, and David Mendes da Silva now brings his third proof. Again, it appears to be a very, very good proof. So the Arizal wrote a Siddur, not to be confused with the Tilat Hashem Siddur, which is Nusach Ari, but he wrote the Siddur of the Ari. And he also wrote, the Arizal also wrote a mystical autobiography called Magid Meisharim, which we need to look into at some stage. I think we should do it. Yosef Karo, far from being a sober jurist, was a very, very radical mystic. I'm not saying he wasn't a sober jurist, but he was also a very, very, very radical mystic. He had a Magid who was called the Mishnah, visited him at nighttime, and he records what the Magid told him. And it is astounding. You actually have to read it to believe it. But again, we'll do that some other time. But in this book, Magid Meisharim, Rabbi Yosef Karo records the Magid, this heavenly teacher, this heavenly being, probably an angel or something like that, appears to him and tells him that he must go to shul on time, or he must even go to shul early. Why must he go early? Mm-hmm. In order to daven in order, without leaving out any parts of the davening. And then you have Yosef Karo writing, because if you mix up the order, you confound the conduits of heaven. The pipes get muddled up in Shemaim. So that is something that's actually taken from the work Magid Meisharim, the autobiography, the spiritual, the mystical autobiography of Rabbi Yosef Karo. And clearly there we see that if you mix up the order of davening, you're mixing up the pipes that contain the flow of the shefa of the spiritual sustenance for the universe. And this seems to be a very, very good proof that you should therefore forego the Amidah with the community so that you don't mix up the heavenly pipes.
the problem being, again, that that this quote from the Arizal does not, or the quote from the Arizal quoting the Magid Mesharim does not actually say anything about weighing the proper order of the tefillot with the obligation to pray as a community.
That's exactly right.
It's kind of a proof text, but not really.
It's not really, because what the Magid tells him is to go to shul early. There you have it. He said, go to shul early, almost saying that you must say the Amidah with the community. Go to shul early if you want to pray slower. Go to shul early, but say the Amidah with the community. So it actually works against David Mendes da Silva, and it does appear to be a support for normative halakha. But then David Mendes da Silva had I suppose, the Spanish version of chutzpah. He then says, well, Yosef Caro, when this got pointed out to him, he says, Yosef Caro wouldn't have seen the section in the Zohar that he brought as a quote. And he says that if he did see it, he probably forgot it. So he again says that, yes, Yosef Caro did write that, but had he seen the Zohar, he would not have written that. So, yeah. You know, he's really now grasping at straws when his third argument has been dealt with by Rabbi Yitzchak Sasportas.
It is grasping at straws. It is, you know, to make an argument saying, well, you know, this, he didn't see this particular text, and if he had, he wouldn't have written the way that he did. Yeah. It is. You know, it's an interesting argument to try to make. I think that that's not an argument one could make in today's day and age, but perhaps it would have been more credible in, you know, in an era where texts were not distributed as widely as they are now. But, you know, this comes down to, you know, or what we're talking about in today's episode is how practice is decided and what weight traditional understanding has versus the understanding brought by the Zohar. And it's a tricky thing, right? There's no clear-cut rule. Haphazard is the word that you used in the article.
Yeah. Let's put it this way. The concept is not haphazard. The concept is very, very clear. One paskens halacha by the Talmud and by halachic poskim. This is a very, very well-known principle across the board. Even Kabbalists generally use it. One paskens halacha by the Talmud, by the Shulchan Aruch, not by the Zohar. But very often things get thrown in. Now, to be perfectly honest, Rabbi Yosef Caro, on a number of occasions, actually paskened by the Zohar, going even against his rule and his principle that one doesn't. He threw in a couple of things, and there are a couple of examples that we can go into at some stage where he actually does paskin according to the Zohar. But generally speaking, he doesn't. I use the word haphazard in terms of often a lot of these mystical practices get thrown in, sort of interwoven within the general fabric of halacha. And that process is a haphazard process. A lot of people would not admit that anything in halacha is haphazard, but somehow the fact that some things are sometimes included, some mystical concepts are sometimes included, and sometimes they're not, appears to be haphazard, because even people who speak against it sometimes include mystical practices within the format of general halacha. But everybody generally agrees with the principle that you don't mix mysticism and halacha.
Mm-hmm. Right. But nonetheless, this practice of David Mendes da Silva stuck, right? So the Rav Yitzchak Sasportas, I guess, was unable to persuade him, and the people around him were unable to persuade him to abandon this practice of, you know, sticking very rigorously to the order of the davening, and, you know, his practice of foregoing praying the Shemoneh Esrei with the community in favor of reciting everything in order. So they couldn't convince him to stop. But not only that, they were concerned about what influence he might have on the community at large through this practice, and I guess also through his claimed sources for this practice. And so there was some pushback.
Yes, and it does appear as if Yitzhak Sasportas was now becoming somewhat angry, because generally speaking, throughout the entire debate, he doesn't mention David Mendes da Silva. He doesn't mention Nathan Curiel. He doesn't mention any names. He talks about Ruvain and Shimon, in other words, A and B. So he's very,
placeholders.
He's very, very polite. He doesn't want to upset anybody. But it appears as if when he saw that David Mendes da Silva wasn't going to give up this practice, and that it probably was beginning to gain, well, it certainly was beginning to gain traction, he becomes a little bit insulting to David Mendes da Silva, and he refers to him as a minor local rabbi in one particular instance. And in another instance, he says that David Mendes da Silva has wrapped himself in the talus, in a talus that is not his. In other words, that David Mendes da Silva has considered himself to be a greater person than he really is. He shouldn't be trying to create new customs, and he shouldn't be trying to perpetuate non-halachic behaviors, but he's wrapped himself in a talus that is not his. He's wrapped himself in a rabbinic talus. He's not a poisek, and he shouldn't be paskening for the people. But it does appear as if people followed that particular practice. And truth be told, to this day, I still followed this practice until a couple of weeks ago, to be quite frank, when I researched this particular case. But it certainly is a very, very common, a very common practice.
And in addition to the concern that Sasportas and his peers may have had about whether David Mendes da Silva had a proper authority, you know, the proper stature to institute something like this, they were also concerned that he probably was a Sabbatian, right? Or that he was heavily influenced.
Right. And there's a lovely clue. It's not 100% convincing, but it's convincing enough. David Mendes da Silva is picked out by Yitzhak Sasportas for no longer attending Shiurim. So I don't think he stopped going to Shiurim because he was no longer frum. I think he was very frum. I think he was very, very frum. In fact, I think he was so frum that he stopped going to Shiurim because he now knew more than people could teach him. No one could teach him anything anymore. And I believe that's why he stopped going to classes. He stopped going to the classes of his former teacher. And the name of his teacher is given in the correspondence, very, very interesting, as Shin Aleph. That's the name of his teacher, Shin Aleph. Now, there were two rabbis in Amsterdam at the time who had the initials Shin Aleph. One was someone called Shlomo Oliveira, and the other was a rabbi also called Rabbi Shlomo Eilon or Eilion. Rabbi Shlomo Eilion, very, very interesting person. At one stage, I believe he was a chief rabbi of England, and he became then the chief rabbi of Amsterdam, and he was the rabbi of the Portuguese synagogue that we've been speaking about. Why is he so interesting? Because he was a student of Nathan of Gaza at some stage, one of the ideologues of the Sabbatian movement, and that is absolutely fascinating. And it does seem as if Shlomo Eilon, the initials Shin Aleph, may have been a reference to his teacher, Rabbi Shlomo Eilon. And Rabbi Shlomo Eilon got embroiled in many controversies in Amsterdam with the Chacham Tzvi, the father of Rabbi Yaakov Emden. And he got embroiled in all sorts of debates regarding the Sabbateans and the anti-Sabbateans. He became quite a controversial figure. And he even excommunicated the Chacham Tzvi from Amsterdam at one stage. So it does appear as if the suspicions of Sabbatean influence played a role in this entire debate, because it just, everything just fits in so nicely and everything so beautifully compartmentalized. We have the Sabbateans and the anti-Sabbateans, Yitzchak Sasportas, his father's Yaakov Sasportas, the Chacham Tzvi gets involved. In fact, this case is even recorded in a responsum of the Chacham Tzvi himself. This very case is to be found there as well. So all the players are there, all the teachers are there, and it just appears to be that the main concern, I personally imagine that the main concern was not so much a concern of conversos, but a concern that this would be a subversive attempt to introduce new mystical practices into Judaism, which is exactly what the Sabbateans at that time were doing, just 40 years after the death of Shabtai Tzvi, when the Jewish world was permeated with these people on the surface appeared to be mainstream Jews, mainstream rabbis, but they still believed that Shabtai Tzvi in one form or another was going to come back, or that somebody else would come, provided that we just did what we had to do at that particular stage. And that's why there's also an emphasis on pietistic practices, strict practices like this, mystical practices, to try and even do a tikkun so that what went wrong with Shabtai Tzvi could still perhaps be salvaged in some mystical sense. And then the redemption could find its fulfillment.
In the end, you know, although the Sabbateans are gone, and, you know, except, you know, perhaps like as we spoke about in one of our earlier episodes, little bits of traces here and there of the Sabbateans that have kind of come down to us, this pseudo or possibly Sabbatean process or practice, I should say, has persisted in a way. David Mendes da Silva won because his practice became mainstream in huge portions of the Jewish world.
It's so interesting. He lost the debate, but he won. I think it's a classical case of, in this sense, losing the battle but winning the war.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And funny enough, the Mishneh Berurah, which was published in the late 19th century, is a halachic work written by Rabbi Yisrael Meir HaKohen, famous halachic work, the Mishneh Berurah, actually writes that pious people, righteous men, have the practice to pray in order for this particular reason, you know, so that you don't damage the pipes in the upper realms, in the lower realms. And this is what they do when they arrive in shul late. You can actually see that in Mishneh Berurah in chapter 52. In fairness, he does go on to say that that is not the standard halacha and one shouldn't follow that practice. But he does mention that righteous men have this practice. So in a sense, he is condoning this practice for the righteous few, which is fascinating, because David Mendes was probably a secret Sabbatean. His practice was clearly a non-halachic practice. He had lost all the debates in the halachic courts, yet the practice stuck. And his practice seems to be even recorded in the sober Mishneh Berurah, although everyone is not encouraged necessarily to do it. It's still mentioned. So in a sense, David Mendes da Silva's practice became codified, in a sense, within Jewish law, and became thereafter, as I say, widespread, to the extent that so many people do this today. If you go into many, many shuls in the world today, someone comes into shul late, no one will even look at you if you carry on davening in the middle of the Shmoneh Esrei when everybody else is saying Shmoneh Esrei. If you carry on davening in the order of the prayers and you're still holding somewhere in Pesukei Dezimra, no one will even pay any attention or even bat an eyelid, because it is a completely normative practice in many circles today.
And not a practice that people tie to Kabbalah necessarily, or that people tie to Sabbateanism or anything like that.
I think that people would be astounded if they knew where this custom came from. Someone mentioned to me subsequent to this article that the Sfaradim have a custom that the Sfaradim are encouraged to keep this mystical custom. And I pointed out to this person that the Sfaradi work was a work that was written in the 1900s. There's no Sephardic source prior to 1706 encouraging people to follow this particular custom. So even though some Sephardim might have this custom and might even have written about this, they would have written about it, much like the Mishneh Berurah, post-1706. But there does not appear to be, I'm certainly not aware of any source prior to 1706 endorsing such behavior. So it does look as if this custom stems purely from David Mendes da Silva in the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam in 1706.
Really fascinating. And from there, spread all around the Jewish world and through time. This has been a really great discussion, Gavin. I learned a lot through, you know, reading this article and this discussion with you. I had no idea that this was the origin of this practice. And I think our listeners probably will also find similarly that they've gotten a new insight on where this practice originated and the influence of the Zohar and of Kabbalah and possibly even of Sabbatian ideals in this era. Thank you so much.
Jordan, thank you so much. All the best to you.
Hi, everybody. Jordan here with a special request. If you're enjoying our podcast, please tell your friends and please also consider giving us a rating or a review on iTunes or whichever other podcast service you use to listen to us. The reviews help us reach more listeners and they're really greatly appreciated. Thanks again and see you next time.